Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and that all that nasty selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal revival, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to squabble over. You can call us from the U.S. to 877-876-5227, from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. For information and links from these shows, you can go to offthegridstofreedom.blogspot.com or email me. Lots is happening, and lots needs to happen to make freedom for each of us real. My blog site is titled How the Neocons Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, the story up just a few hours ago is titled How the Secrets of the Exodus Will Save America. Our guest today will be talking about those discoveries that he made that have the potential to change the world in which we will all live. So stay tuned for that. That article goes exactly to our show today. But now it is time for our Ron Paul update. Ron Paul introduces American Freedom Agenda Act. Would you believe it? Something good happening in Congress. Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul of Texas introduced a bill in the House of Representatives 4 days ago that would protect many of the freedoms that had been undermined by the Bush administration. And here's a little article written by Walt Thiessen, a libertarian. Texas Republican presidential candidate Dr. Ron Paul introduced legislation in the House of Representatives this past Tuesday that would counteract some of the worst abuses of the Bush administration against individual rights in America and abroad. Entitled American Freedom Agenda Act of 2007, the bill is wide-sweeping in scope. Among the protections included in the bill are that it would repeal the Military Commissions Act of 2006, prohibit the admittance of evidence obtained under torture or coercion in both civilian courts and military tribunals, prohibit acquisition of intelligence that contravenes the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, district court to challenge the constitutionality of a presidential signing statement that declares the president's intent to disregard provisions of a bill he has signed into law because he believes they are constitutional. Prohibit all officers and agents of the United States from engaging in kidnapping, imprisonment, and torture abroad based solely on the president's judgment that the person is an enemy combatant. Protect journalists' rights to publish information acquired from the executive branch, with the only exception being when there is a direct, immediate, and irreparable harm to the national security of the United States. Prohibit the use of secret evidence to designate a foreign individual or organization as a terrorist or terrorist organization. It's kind of exciting, isn't it? You can depend on Ron to do the right thing with courage. Both liberals and conservatives are signing on and endorsing the bill. It's the right thing to do, and they can see that. The Ron Paul campaign is reformatting American politics. But there are still a few things we need. One of those is the means for gauging how big the movement really is. That means something like a count-off or a census of the Ron Paul supporters and the money they're using on the real campaign, the campaign that comes straight from the minds and hearts of ordinary people. You can participate in just that, a count-off, a census of supporters at voteforronpaul.net. You can also get your own Ron Paul email address there at the same time. So go there. Go to Ron Paul, voteforronpaul.net and make yourself seen by the media. The results of the census will be used to show the real depth, breadth, and weight of the Ron Paul revolution. That's a message those invested in the status quo need to hear. And no one gets the message out like Ron Paul activists. And now a note on the opposition. Paul Jacobs, the penultimate corporate shill, put out a blog intended to supplement his long whine of the soul at the idea he could conform, he should conform to the law in Oklahoma. You might not have heard, but he was indicted just a few weeks ago for their covert activities there. In that short blog, which he probably did not write himself anyway, he said there is nothing wrong with flipping burgers. I suggest he get to it right away. As he pointed out, it is honest work, and he has a family to support in more comfort than his previous activities ever warranted. If you go look at the website associated with these sellouts of liberty, you will see that none of them support Ron. That includes the Club for Growth, Cato, U.S. Term Limits, the Sam Adams Alliance, Reason, and all the other sellouts who are sucking up money and spitting out disinformation to confuse and destroy the possibilities for real change. By their fruits, you shall know them. And now our update on the Portland false flag that has been going on this week, with thanks to Patty and Captain May for the job that they did. In case you have not heard, there was an incident there, a bomb threat at a local hotel. That came out in the Bush team media. But there is an exchange that took place between Captain May, our guest last week, and Teresa Mitchell, KBOO Press Watch host, on the subject. Dear Captain May, I do appreciate receiving a call from you yesterday afternoon. I have been wondering about that incident, namely the fact that the local media reported that one car had been zeroed in on three times by three different explosive detection dogs, and then determined that it belonged to someone participating in the drill. Shortly thereafter, the story began to drift, as a spokesperson said to the Argonian, that it could be any car, or that, as opposed to their previous confidence, any minute residue could be alerting the dogs. Naturally, this brings questions to mind. What was in the car after all? Why did they stop talking about that one car if three different dogs identified it? I have to wonder if some stunt was shut down there, and then, as you suggested. It seemed to me, even if absolutely nothing was in the car, then they would have taken the thing apart anyway, to be sure. But there's no further report. And then there's the fact that they shut down the nearby Max trucks for 40 blocks. How big did they think it was? It's another case of behavior not matching statements, as far as I can tell, signed Teresa. And here's the letter from Captain May to Teresa. Dear Teresa, I agree with you that there's plenty of room for skepticism about the official story of yesterday's dog alert. Regardless of the details, which you demonstrate below to be in flux, the simple facts are that the incident occurred at exactly the same time and place where the emphasis of the terror drill was moving, the DoubleTree Hotel. Beelzebub, a.k.a. Michael Chernoff, was scheduled to be there and may have been there for all I know. Please inform if you have specific knowledge that he was there. A large area of downtown Portland was cordoned off. Police presence and efforts intensified greatly, and movement by people within the affected area was restricted. I would say that the exercise was semi-live yesterday afternoon and that no one can deny that it had gone beyond its stated parameters. I consider all the official statements parroted by the press as worthless. We can glean details from them, but even these are contradictory as often as not. I believe we consider three possibilities for yesterday's Portland bomb scare. One, the official story, which began with hints that there might have been an effort at disrupting the exercise, presumably by Portland conspiracy theorists, and finished with that you have described a flimsy story that it was all an innocuous detection. The final official story is a coincidence theory. Everything that happened, they say, was sheer coincidence, and there is nothing to be suspicious about. Anyone who thinks otherwise, they say, is engaging in conspiracy theory, meaning the theory that what happened was not a coincidence. The bomb scare was contrived so that the area could be prepared for a false flag event. This is the second one. The possibility that this was the case diminishes with each passing moment, since false flags are easier to conduct in the middle of an exercise rather than on the last day, let alone at the last hour. As I write, it is now Friday afternoon in Portland, and the exercise is beginning to demobilize. 3. The bomb scare was contrived so that a prepared false flag terror event could be dismantled. The coincidence of the bomb scare with the Doubletree Chertoff and the exercise plot argues in favor of this view of things. Further, the occurrence of a predicted explosive event in Southeast Texas petroleum industry earlier yesterday, combined with a major Al-Qaeda false flag event in Pakistan, also argues in favor of this view. I believe that the third possibility, that the bomb scare was a diversion to allow for the deconstruction of the false flag setup, is the most likely. And the letter goes on. And so that's our follow-up. Keep listening for more and contact Captain May at captainmay@prodigy.net. And now some thoughts for the week ahead. You are living through a revolution that has been in motion for a while now. We tend to point to moments in time when a specific event creates enough shift so that we can see the accumulated changes that have actually been taking place for what can have been a very long period of time. What's happening now has been a long revolution. It is a movement through time, taking us from a place of slavery and servitude, forced dependence on rulers and ignorance, to a place of self-actualizing knowledge and individual freedom. America is the vision that brings all of that together. On this show, we've been talking about the problems we must confront. But while we work, it's important to remember that this is not a revolt against anything as much as it is a movement towards something that humanity has never known before. It's an exciting time because individuals are coming together, finding that they have the same goals and ideas, and are beginning instantly to work together to build the needed tools that will allow us to move into that new world full of promise and hope. Some of those tools come into our hands through innovations in technology. Some come to us from the distant past, now seen through different eyes. Those tools hold the potential for restoring the earth and help in building a human world that is about consent, persuasion, and simple decency. Augustus Franklin has been on a life journey toward this moment in time, looking for answers to questions. Questions can be funny things. They can take you to answers you did not know you needed. Mr. Franklin is an astrophysicist and a scientist of all trades, whose insights will eventually land him a Nobel Prize. Please welcome Augustus Franklin.
How are you doing today?
I am just fine, and I am so glad that you could be here with us today.
It's a pleasure. It really is.
Well, it's a pleasure for both of us. Now, why don't we start by you telling us about the turning points that brought you to where we are right now?
Well, it's kind of an interesting series of assembling bits of knowledge that didn't really connect until later on, when other studies were producing evidence of that would support the earlier knowledge. Back in 93, when the space station program was transitioned to a Boeing Corporation or company, I was one of the designers with Grumman Aerospace, and I took a sabbatical. Instead of trying to get into other aerospace companies to make weapons, I decided to take an educational sabbatical. So I took off, and I was at University of Chicago and Hyde Park and Open University in London and University of Maryland and a bunch of places all over the place, doing a cosmological study, finding out how the high cultures in the ancient past described the coming into being of the solar system, and seeing if there was a common thread, and of course there was. And during this reading, I was in the University of Chicago, and I was reading these tales in the Garden of Eden. Actually, it's the Eden in the Sumerian, because this was the cuneiform text that had been translated, and found these references to this stuff called manna, and the stuff that is being used on these gardens that only the gods would eat foods from. And I thought, isn't that interesting? So that was about 1997, and I came out to California about 2000, and by 2002 I was digesting gold down into monoatomic states for ambient temperature superconductors, and noticed these same colors as described in these 7,000-year-old tests. And I thought, isn't that odd? And didn't do a thing with it. And so what I did was about 2 years later, I decided, you know, what are the odds? Why not try it? So I did the ancient methods of creating this stuff based on what I already knew about attaining these correct colors and started growing plants, and I got walnuts the size of apricots out of the hull.
Wow.
And I'm going, holy moly, this looks like this supports the Garden of Eden and the Genesis tales, and it's just duplicating what God was using on the plants. And I've, you know, it's for sale, and, you know, I started a company, and we're doing that. And so I got more into this because in the Bible there are many, many references to manna and the bread of the presence and gold in this state and bdellium and all these cross references of color and type and all references to gold. And then I started studying the Exodus because manna is described in the Genesis as things that were seen in the Exodus, and the Exodus describes things that were seen in the Genesis in color. And that gold, or actually the manna, fell on the Hebrews in the morning as like a milky dew that would evaporate into coriander-sized seeds, which were about a couple of millimeters in size, mm-hmm. and the color of manna. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Manna's over here, and you got coriander over here, and you got, you know, the stuff of the Exodus and manna and stuff. And I'm going, So I started working on the issue and got more into the history of Moses himself and being adopted. And, you know, he was found in the reeds in the Nile, was adopted into the royal family, which immediately makes him a priest of the Temple of Amon, which is the Temple of the Hidden. And he would know all about transforming gold into these breads of eternity that the pharaohs used. So when he took the Hebrews out of Egypt into the wilderness, it's interesting that all the archaeological sites that support where Moses went and where he stayed for the longest time are very close to gold mining sites and housing sites.
And you bet that you've actually researched that so that you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's exactly where he was.
Well, my research supports five or six other major researchers that actually place Mount Sinai in the Arabian Peninsula, in Midian, outside of the Sinai. So actually, he crossed the Sinai across the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, where we found chariot wheels and bones and all this stuff, which supports the parting of the Red Sea. Well, it's actually the Gulf of Aqaba, we think he went across, and he ended up at Jebel El Lawaz, which is Mount Sinai at Rephidim, which is where Flinders Petrie found the Temple of Hathor and the remains of the first tabernacle, probably, altars to sacrifice things, gold, and so forth. But again, you have to ask the question, where did they get the gold? Did they bring the gold with them? They made a temple. They made the Ark of the Covenant out of gold. They made all these tables and chairs and stuff in the temple out of gold. They had to be processing gold.
Mm-hmm.
So my research matches, you know, five or six major researchers that support the idea that he went where the gold was, because as an Egyptian member of the royal family and an Egyptian priest of the Temple of Amon, they know where all the gold is. So
he wasn't wandering around randomly in the desert. He had a mission.
Well, I think he had several missions, one of which was to bring this population into a new nation, give them a series of things that they could hold on to these traditions, and feed them food that he knew that would keep them alive even without food. I mean, if you think about what they were eating, if they were eating a form of transformed gold, then and it kept them alive, there's a big story there.
That is.
Yeah. And the gold that I transform at Caltech turns to a white powder, just like they talk about the manna falling from the sky. But there's a lot of details there. If you look at the tabernacle, it looks like a smelting operation. They've got this large enclosed tent area, and in that tent area is another structure, and now that structure was a plume of smoke all the time. There's their pillar of clouds they talk about.
Wow.
So what I think was happening was Moses would go in there with his goldsmith Bezalel, and I think he was teaching Bezalel the Egyptian transformation of gold into this material. And they produced this large plume. The plume fell in the morning after the Israelites woke up. They found this wonderful stuff they could gather up and make a type of bread out of. And it sustained them for like 40 years in the desert.
Well, so they were having something that was, one, very expensive and very unusual.
Well, it wasn't
for a long period of time.
It wasn't expensive to them. Remember, this is just a natural source. In the rock, they were crushing and putting into a furnace and exhausting a lot of vapor into the air that would fall down and making a lot of gold metal they could make all their artifacts out of.
It was a byproduct for them, too.
It was many byproducts. You ended up with metallic gold and vaporous gold.
Huh. Yeah. And, of course, the mana was supposed to fall for 6 days, and then on the seventh day, it didn't fall.
Well, that's because they stoked the furnaces for 6 days. What they actually did back then was they had a stoking operation where you would have these big bellows, and you'd stoke the furnace with very hot flames, which cuts down the amount of fuel you have to use,
mm-hmm.
and increases the temperature that you need. And they'd fill these things up, and they'd stoke them and burn them and cook them for like 5 or 6 days at a time, and then you turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
So 6 days on, 1 day off, 1 day it didn't fall the next day. Simple archaeological evidence and simple mining techniques matching the toils in the Exodus.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Moses was pretty clever.
And there are a lot of, you take a look at what was happening then in the Exodus and what his agenda was, it removes a lot of the uncertainty, like the wandering in the desert thing.
It really wasn't wandering so much. He knew exactly where he went. In fact, if you look at his path, the way of the wilderness, the Red Sea, and the route of the Hebrew Exodus,
mm-hmm.
they make a beeline right across the middle of the Sinai over to the Gulf of Aqaba, and then head directly south to the gold mining region on the western edge of Saudi Arabia. And huge mines, huge amounts of gold are found on the western side of Saudi Arabia because it basically sits on a Paleozoic and a Precambrian rock structures, which come out of the reaction series of rocks right about the temperature with quartz, okay, and quartz and gold come out at right about the same temperature, about 1,100 centigrade.
Huh.
So they harden up, form these big veins, and they're all over the place. In fact, one of Solomon's mines is predicted to be about 160 kilometers, about 290 miles away from Jeddah, up in the sort of the middle section of Saudi Arabia.
That's amazing.
Well, it wasn't Saudi Arabia then. It was part of the Assyrian Empire and the Persian empires and all these things.
What did you feel like when you first produced these little bits of stuff that they're white and pearly and about the size of a coriander seed?
What was it like to actually?
What was it like to hold it in your hand?
Well, I sent you a picture of that, and it was just like, my jaw just dropped. It was like, oh, I'll be darned. I would have used a different word, but it would have been, a profanity, right?
Right.
So it was like, I'll be darned. There's the stuff. It's white. It's pearlescent. It's the size of coriander seeds, and it's made out of gold.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy cow. So recently I've been baking into bread. Man, the bread is very, very good, just like...
Wow!
They used in the Exodus.
Do you notice any difference in you now that you're consuming this regularly?
Well, it's subjective. Okay, there's no objective observations because I'm not in a clinical, condition. But I do know this: I get really, really interesting dreams now. The dream state is very lucid, and I have lots of energy, and I'm getting. Faster nail growth, faster hair growth, my exfoliation, improves, so my skin is getting rid of wrinkles because it's just a really good movement of skin now.
You're getting rid of wrinkles.
Yeah.
So you're looking younger.
Well, from the inside out. It's not like something I put on. It's something
mm-hmm.
that seems to be working with the genetics of the cells themselves or some aspect of the production of oils or hydration in the skin. I mean, there's a variety of explanations where we could account for this, but something's activating it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that and I also eat my foods. And I use the stuff that's used in the Garden of Eden on my garden foods, which, of course, complements this, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've been offering that online now as ASAP Plant Minerals at ASAPorganics.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just buy the stuff and put it on your crops, and you'll get those, huge walnuts. And last year in Austin, we got 3-inch pecans and... strawberry leaves.
3-inch pecans.
Oh, yeah. In 1 year. What happens is these minerals, which are basically 17 essential micromineral nutrients that have been stripped out of soil because everybody's putting nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus on it.
Now, tell us a little bit about micronutrients and why this makes a huge difference in rebuilding the Earth's soil.
Well, all your microorganisms require them. If you're putting all these heavy nitrogen fertilizers and having this incredible imbalance in nutrients, then the micronutrients get stripped out with the crops every harvest. If they're not replenished, the microorganisms are starved, and they can't produce a robust, biodiverse soil structure that ends up at its apex with the earthworms that produce these nutrients for free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this factory farming thing that's been done has actually stripped our soils, addicted us to these heavy chemicals, and because it's so unbalanced, the crops are attracted to insects. So the insects come in and eat the crops, they put the petrochemicals on it. And isn't it interesting that when you look at how phytochemicals are put in food, it's put in the skins of food generally, especially in berries.
Yes.
And we're told to take those off before we eat them, which immediately makes us have to buy supplements to be able to get nutrition.
So at every point, what should be natural and easy and cheap becomes expensive and not really good for you at all.
Yeah, and usually by agencies that have other agendas with industry that, you know, confound this and addict us to products we don't need to buy.
And we shouldn't be, because it's killing us.
Yeah, just put back in the soil what we've stolen out of the soil and let the soil rebuild itself and grow plants naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Where you get all the phytochemicals and all the stuff you need. And what these minerals do, and this is the thing that most people don't understand, without these phytochemical nutrients, okay, the nutrients that go into the ground to get taken up into the microorganisms, get taken up into the plant, into the chloroplast,
mm-hmm.
be converted into these phytochemicals that are noted, like in blueberries and so forth, that, you know, reverse macular degeneration, fix your renal tissue, are great antioxidants, you know, like in spinach, you know, it prevents brain damage, nerve damage, prevents memory loss. All the things that are in there that can do that can only be there if you've got adequate micronutrients in the soil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if you just feed them NPK, they get big and look like they're plants. But that's why the taste is so thin in crops these days that are raised that way.
I mean, because that's what happens. I mean, you'll eat something that looks pretty good, but it leaves you hungry still.
Absolutely.
And that's because your body really knows that it isn't getting what it has to have.
It's empty.
It's slow starvation.
Well, you know, it's, you know, you may as well eat a tennis ball.
You know? Well, that's not really very attractive, is it?
Well, as long as you take the skin of the tennis ball off. I mean, you know, so that's the thing that we're trying to get going in the movement. We're OMRI listed. We're working in the organic farms. And of course, our stuff works on non-organic because it's just delivering minerals back. So
mm-hmm.
what I want to do is remineralize our soils and take this stranglehold off of the American consumer to buy all these products and health products and supplemental products they don't really need if they just got it in their food.
Mm-hmm.
Remineralize our soils. That's all we really have to do.
And, of course, all of those things have a very negative impact on everybody's health in other ways we haven't even gone into yet.
Sure.
And, of course, if that's not going into the soil, therefore into the food and into us, then that's another layer of things we aren't going to have to worry about.
Precisely.
Which is taking us back to, again, what you're defining as the original condition of the earth.
Yeah, robust, biodiverse, healthy, full of nutrients.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, it is, but really when you think about it, it's so simple. It's just so simple. You know, if you put all these heavy fertilizers on your ground, the plants have to be able to grow and extract all the micronutrients that may be left until finally they just deplete it. And you end up with these grasses that they feed cows that, you know, they're noticing reductions in milk output because these particular micronutrients are required to stimulate lactation in cattle. And probably humans too, for that matter. And that without these things in the food, they have to give the cattle a large amounts of just, you know, powdered minerals and vitamins and all this stuff. I was talking to a woman yesterday, and she was telling me she was about to buy our product. She goes, "Well, I'm about to, you know, put these vitamins and so forth on my crops and my ground." I said, "Well, wait a minute. Why are you putting vitamins on your ground? Because plants make vitamins if they have micronutrients. You
mm-hmm.
don't need to put vitamins on your ground." And when I finally explained it to her, she also realized that you need to use less of these, you know, nitrogen-based fertilizers when you have the microminerals.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have the microminerals, use lots and lots of fertilizer. And I tested this out on our crops where we just use the microminerals. And you have to use proportionally more microminerals to get the crops to go correctly because you have a proportionally less amount of NPK. So really nature has a 17-element system that when it's balanced, it's like a machine. It just works for you. It's beautiful.
That's amazing.
Yeah. God did a good job. You know? I mean, you think about it, this planet is a very, very special place. And, it's the way we mess with it kind of, you know, puts things out of balance.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Garden of Eden.
Eden?
Eden.
That's what the Sumerians called it. You got to remember, Sumeria was about 800 years before the Akkadian culture erupted, and Akkad is the Akkadian Hebrew, and they took all the Sumerian tales and translated them, and you'll notice something interesting that I noticed when I was doing these studies. The Akkadian Hebrew starts, you know, God said this and God said that, and God was, you know, second person narrative. In the cuneiform texts from Sumeria, it's in the first person.
Mm-hmm.
I am God, and on this planet I did these things, and I made humans, and I grew these foods, and I did this and that and so forth. So
you have God speaking in the first person.
Well, who's writing the text is presenting themselves as God in the first person. That's true. And like all things that are mythological, the belief systems start from a real event. How it gets changed from language to language and storyteller to storyteller is another issue, but they always have an inception point from a real factual event, like Ezekiel in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Ezekiel saw something in the desert, and he recorded the best he could with the knowledge he had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And so that's really what you were looking for in sifting back through this. You were finding the facts,
yeah.
And then you were using science in many ways to prove the Bible.
Well, in a sense, you're absolutely right. You know, if it's not, it's enough to believe because it works. You know, the belief system works, but it's also curiously comfortable in my mind to use physics and science, geology, archaeology, metallurgy, these intense studies of disciplines to understand in a different way how to understand things that weren't really talked about, but they were inferred.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, one day you didn't take the manna because it wasn't there, and you had to take a second, you know, double portion the day before it didn't fall, and the furnaces were operating on a regular schedule, and I'm sure that Moses would use that schedule, which he learned from the Temple of Amun, to run these furnaces the way it would work to make the stuff he needed to feed the Israelites, to make the gold, et cetera, et cetera. But see how interesting it is to be able to be in that tent with him and
mm-hmm.
be next to he and Bezalel while they're making the gold at night. Because all this is alchemy, and alchemy, making gold and making the elixirs of life. You know, they would make gold during the day for the kings, the alchemists, but at night they'd be trying to recreate the elixirs of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that furnace was going day and night.
And he certainly would have known that because he was a high priest of Amun, been a member of the royal family.
And if you look at the breads, you know, the bread of eternity from the Egyptian pharaohs, it's in all the tomb drawings. It's a conical, triangular-shaped bread in a cup. And if you look at what you know, God told Moses to tell Aaron, gather about an omer of manna and put it in a cup in the Ark of the Covenant. You know, so it's you have these very clear transfers of knowledge that go from Egypt into the new Judea states and the state of Israel, which is very similar the way the cosmological theories worked, which was my original study when I left NASA. If you'll notice, what happens is every culture gathers the knowledge from the previous culture and rewrites it into its own.
So they recreated it as a mythology because they don't really believe it. So you're saying it's a falling away of belief, really, that took the knowledge away from us.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, but again, it's the same knowledge, just rewritten. Like, if you look at the pantheons of the Egyptians to the Greeks to the Romans, I mean, if you look at the pantheon members and their powers and their knowledge and their representative, you know, personifications of forces, they're the same guys with different names.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The god in Sumeria that made the humans was Enki, which means Lord of the Earth. The god of the Hebrews was Yahweh and the Elohim, okay, those who have descended from heaven. You know, you get different names to describe it within their framework, but it's the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting, though, is if every one of these tales say that these guys are immortal because they eat the food from the Garden of Eden, so if I'm right about my foods and I'm right about the product that I'm selling, you know, online, I'll be able to tell you about it in 100 years.
Well, and of course, anybody who buys the product would be able to tell you too if that really works.
Well, yeah, like I said, food tastes better, flowers smell more fragrant, plants grow more robustly, they produce double-sized nuts. After the first year, you'll get these the larger variations showing up. You'll get a much better production of nuts, but and then get you know several examples on the clusters of these double-sized nuts. And in year two and three, there's a complete conversion of the tree over to the larger size.
So you've been doing these studies for a while, and
about
actually
5 years, yeah.
How many years?
About 5 years. Now.
5 years you've been doing this.
Well, actively applying the knowledge. I've known it since 1997.
Mm-hmm. And of course, what you're talking about here is an answer to so many of the different issues that we're confronting. This changes our entire relationship with soil and with where our food comes from.
Exactly, and it's almost like a spiritual thing. You are once again, okay, the steward. We were the steward. Remember what they say in Eden? We were the stewards of the garden, not
mm-hmm.
the butchers. We were the stewards. And to go back into this, it's not that I'm, a terribly religious man. I have to be very honest with your audience. I don't worship on a regular basis. I believe I have a direct connection with the spirit, and I'm part of the reparation movement because of that, which is how our country developed. But it does give me a stronger connection to life by being able to see these things by my own hand. I love the Bible. The Bible is a wonderful book. It has great stories, but it's not just stories. It's accurate historical data that you can unravel.
Well, I think that that's probably an extremely respectful way to look at it,
yes.
rather than looking at it as simply a bundling of mythologies.
Well,
that's really what led you to where you are, right? You were looking for the truth in the Bible, and you found it.
Yes, it is.
And that's an amazing story in and of itself.
Well, I'm happier for it, and I'm healthier, too.
Well, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this, you've been on this regimen yourself for how long?
Oh, about a year and a half now.
And you feel that different?
Yes, I do. I mean, last year I grew about maybe 6 or 7 tomato plants.
Mm-hmm.
This year I grew about 40 tomato plants, all different varieties, all different types. And every morning I get up and I make my coffee and I go out and I just eat tomatoes, the ripe tomatoes every morning. And I feel great. I mean, it's great. It's got lycopene. It's got all these great phytochemicals in it. It's not have pesticides. It's grown with my stuff. And I have this abundance of food. Up here at like 4,000 or 5,000 feet in DG granite, I still get great food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
and that's pretty unusual in itself too.
Oh, yeah.
Usually, you get up that high and it's hard to grow it. So you're saying actually that this also increases the range at which people can grow food.
Yeah, it also seems to increase the growing period. I had oregano that in December of last year still had green leaves and flowers and bees visiting it during the day, whereas the side that hadn't been treated was already, dormant and brown stems.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. It really, when you feed plants correctly, like they were meant to be fed with all the 17 minerals, because actually nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus are minerals.
Hmm.
And it's a macro amount they need and a micro amount they need, parts per thousand, parts per thousand, parts per million. And if you have the ratio right, the plants just, they say, thank you. By the way, here, I'll grow big for you now. And they do.
Wow, that's amazing. How have people reacted when they try, when they try the fertilizer?
Well, if you go to the website, which is asaporganics.com, you can see several testimonies. I mean, they were skeptical at first. Now they're presenting it to everybody they can find. And they're treating their other plants with this stuff. I mean, we had a tree last year in Austin, Texas. It was a 26-year-old pecan tree that had never produced any nuts in the length that this woman had lived in her house.
Mm-hmm.
My partner Pamela went over there, didn't even poke the ground. I like to poke the ground and perforate it to put the stuff down in the roots to make sure it's there. She just mixed up the solution and poured the stuff in a big ring around the tree and watered it in like it was a puddle of water around
mm-hmm.
the tree, and put this tree to sleep last fall that way. In the spring, she laid another amount down, and then the tree started getting so many nuts. The trees around it were getting more nuts, too, because in Austin, they had a lot of water last year, so they had a huge production of pecans. But all their branches were breaking. A lot of bow fractures and branch breaking and so forth. And
because there was so much fruit.
Yeah, but this woman's tree that we treated didn't have that. There was no bow fractures, no insults to the limbs. And tons of pecans that had never existed on the tree, and some of them were 3 inches long.
So, and she had never had this on the tree?
Oh, yeah. Then we also had two other groves we tested in Comanche, Texas. And they had similar results, where, again, these were peach tree and pecan orchards, and they had not had any fruit in like 5 or 6, 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put this stuff on their plants, and last fall, and then in the spring, and they ended up getting so much load that the trees were, you know, branches were breaking and bowing and so forth. But they treated it with a normal rate, and these trees were not prepared because for years they had been very dry, so they didn't get the stress to grow the stronger limbs.
Uh huh.
But they still had lots and lots of production. For instance, here's a testimony from Johnny in Comanche. I treated 30 pecan and 20 peach trees with ASAP. I bought my home 3 summers ago, and the trees did not produce any, in some cases, and very little fruit in others in the first 2 growing seasons. The previous owner said he did not remember the pecan trees ever having anything to harvest, and the peach trees had been dying because of lack of care. I treated all the trees, even the ones that looked as if they were dead. I had so much fruit from all the trees that limbs broke because I did not prune the excess. Just one treatment made all this difference. If you do not try this product, you will not realize what a miracle it is. And that's very nice of him to tell us about.
Well, that's wonderful. But, you know, that goes to so many different questions. I mean, here, you know, we're concerned about feeding the number of people on the earth, but what you're talking about is this increases productivity
and
so much that would never be a problem, and it's healthier.
Right. It's the nutrition thing I'm the most amazed with. Because if, you know, we have a lot of third world countries that have a lot of water pollution problems and bad agricultural, you know, arrangements. Right now, I have another nonprofit called the International Green Cross, like the Red Cross, only for plants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a reforestation project going on in Haiti right now, where they had these trees destroyed, and they've replanted, I think, like 1,000 or 1,500 little saplings, and they're using our material on it.
And what's happening there with those?
Well, again, I'm waiting for the first reports to come back, but I'm expecting that they will have accelerated growth and good green cover and, you know, erosional control and all the good things you have from developing strong root systems that have large branching that gather nutrients and also hold the soil in place.
That's amazing.
Well, here's another testimony. This is a woman named Iva. She goes, my daughter treated my roses, grapes, and pecan trees with ASAP. My rose bush has been planted for several years, but had not had that many roses on it, and the limbs were spindly and few. After treating it with ASAP, the limbs went wild and grew and grew. I have bountiful numbers of huge pink roses that have not stopped blooming since it began early to middle May. Everyone wants to know what I did to this plant to make it so beautiful. My pecan trees have the greenest tassels this year I've ever seen since it was planted 15 years ago. Never had so many pecans on my trees. I will continue to use this and share this product with everyone I know.
That's amazing. Also, has any of these actually gone to fairs?
Well, it's so new. You know, I started this company with my partners in Austin last fall. So we're just, you know, completing our first sets and series of experiments to grow these plants. And again, we got our OMRI listing so that we can be used on organic farming because, you know, we really do support organic agriculture. It's really the correct way to go.
Well, yeah, absolutely, of course.
So next year, there's a big farm fair in Tulare I found out about.
Uh-huh.
I'm really sorry I missed this year because I would have loved to meet some of the people, but maybe next year I'll be able to come to the fair and open a booth and bring a bunch of nuts with huge sizes and just say, hey, it works, try it, and see if I can get the San Joaquin interested. We're part of CCLF. So.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel to know that you're going to be making this kind of a difference just in something like World Hunger?
Well, it makes me feel really good. It makes me feel really good. You know, it makes me proud in a way because it's something my father told me to do when I was a little kid. You know,
your dad told you to do this?
Well, in a sense, he said, you know, Augie, which is my nickname.
Uh-huh.
He goes, Augie, you got to remember, the Renaissance man is the man you need to be. And I go, what's that, Dad? And he goes, it's the man that knows science and astronomy and literature and language and agriculture and all this stuff. And I go, how do you learn all that stuff? And he goes, well, just think about it as though you've got a file cabinet. And every topic has a folder. So when you learn something in your head, kind of put it in that folder. And eventually, the folders will talk to each other. And by golly, over time, it's been working for me since I first started doing it.
Folders talk to each other, right?
Sure.
Well, the
chemistry and the physics was talking to the history and the archaeology folders to figure out enough, you know, coincidental topics about this manna food or the Garden of Eden foods and growing crops. And then eventually they said, well, okay, we got a couple of good data points here. Why don't you give it a shot? And I did, and it worked. So I have to thank my dad for this stuff. You know, he's the primary person in my life that set me down this particular path. You know, I was nurtured by my mom, wonderful loving mother, but you know, my dad got me keyed in on this idea of learning as much as you can.
And you've always done that.
Sort of. You know,
and you're always.
I wish I knew a foreign language. And if I did, it would be Mexican or Spanish. I'd love to learn Spanish.
Well, so would you say you're sort of an out-of-the-box thinker because you took a look at, the history the way that you did and the Exodus, which is really one of the things that started us here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Bible even tells us, find out everything and keep that which is good.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say believe whatever you're told. You know, the Hindu's masters will tell you, you can either believe what I'm about to tell you and you'll be happy, or don't believe a thing I'm saying and go out into the world and learn it yourself, and you'll come back to me and we'll be sitting at this same place happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of taken that approach. I question authority. I absolutely do. My great-great-great-great-great-great-great ninth-generation grandfather is Dr. Benjamin Franklin. He was the guy that found out it wasn't lightning that struck the ground because someone was evil. It was electricity. So there's an example of my family line questioning authority and finding out the truth. Because
mm-hmm.
the truth is what it's all about.
Well, exactly. And so you went into the Bible and found the truth where other people hadn't?
Yes. And there's other people out there alive today that I think are seeking the truth, and I like quite a bit. And this is not a pitch, but I do like Ron Paul. I think he's brilliant. I think his idea of issuing letters of marks and reprisals against people that pulled off 9/11 and other things that are going on, he's a great guy. I like him. I like the way he thinks.
Well, I agree with you on that, so we have complete unanimity there.
Yeah, and I like Duncan Hunter, too, as a matter of fact. I think the Paul Hunter ticket would be a great ticket.
Well,
I can't hit all the points with you, can I?
No, you can't hit all the points with me. I think I would prefer a Kucinich ticket.
Okay, I would go with that. I would do it. I like Dennis. He's, like I said, I've met many people down here in Los Angeles, and friends in Los Angeles that support Dennis, and I've seen his videos and I've watched what he has to say, and he's a good man. He's
mm-hmm.
an honest, good man that has good ideas.
What do you think about where we are today in the world? I mean, there's a lot of people, and it's all doom and gloom, and they're scared, and they're worried. But it sounds like, from what you're saying, that there are really a lot of things for us to feel happy and confident about.
First of all, you must understand, I think everybody probably realizes, that we have been under the effects of what I call false flag injected signatures. Things are thrown in the news to get our attention, and things are thrown in the news that are not correct to make us think certain ways. And this is, again, be very skeptical. Look past what you think is the surface, because there's always something underneath it. This was seen clearly on 9/11 with all the spoilation of evidence and the spin doctoring, blaming Al-Qaeda on all this stuff. A bunch of guys in the mountains of Afghanistan somehow hijacked jets in Boston and Newark and Dulles. It's hard to comprehend. And even Bin Laden said he didn't do it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Then you end up with all these weird released videos that are mysteriously found with people that kind of look like Bin Laden saying all this stuff in Arabic that it's being translated by CIA translators. It's like, man, there's a level of discomfort there. Not that the Iraq War hasn't fomented a huge new, army of people with anger, but I think that everybody's being played for fools. If you have guys pretending to be Sunnis and attacking Shiites, then the Shiites are going to think the Sunnis attack them, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I think the American public's biggest problem right now is the quality of the information that's being fed to them.
Yes, it's like that. It matches the quality of the food they get in the grocery store.
Right. It's injected false signature. You're told something is safe when it's not. You're convinced to go ahead and eat it, even though you instinctually feel as though, this doesn't taste good. It tastes kind of rubbery. It doesn't have a really good taste,
Mm-hmm.
You know instinctually.
You do, and you get you. It doesn't have the savor. It doesn't leave you feeling satisfied and happy.
Right.
Like your body has really been, nurtured and nourished.
Well, nourishment is what it's all about, body and soul. You can't separate either one and have anything be alive. You have to feed the spirit. You have to feed the body, and and those things together give you life.
Absolutely. And if people want to get in touch with you, let's how do they do that about the plant food? You said it's at asaporganics.com.
.com. It's just one word. ASAP Organics. Or info@asaporganics.com for questions.
And if people, now you also have a site for your for the products that come from the manna.
Well, that's the manna stuff. Oh, no, that's the Garden of Eden food. The manna thing is Judah's Bakery, because the house of Judah and the house of Benjamin were the houses that were from the Temple of the Essene, which followed the teachings of Moses and stopped doing animal sacrifices. They gave other types of prayer and other types of grain, bread sacrifices, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things of Moses. Is you've got to stop killing these animals. I mean, there's a whole thing going on here that wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
And so their houses, did that. And the house of Judah, of course, we remember in our movies, Ben-Hur was the house of Judah,
Yes.
And, trials and tribulations and so forth.
And that site is Judah's Bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And I will put up a link on my Connect, my Off the Grids site, so people can go find that, too.
Oh, yeah. And we make the breads, the shoe bread with the real manna in it, and we also make... It's very expensive because it takes a lot of effort to...
Well, it's gold.
Yeah, it is. It's transformed gold. I think I don't have to explain that in too great a detail.
No, but the idea that you could actually taste real manna, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And it's good bread.
That's amazing. I mean, when you think about what that means in terms of the history of the world, reconnecting with something that everybody's wondered about,
mm-hmm.
like what was that stuff that fell? Hello?
Yes. Yeah.
And now, here it is.
And now I can eat some.
And wow, now I can actually taste it and know.
Right. And why not? I mean, why would I keep this for myself? This is a heritage that we all have. So to be able to bring that back and to be able to bring these foods and this ability to grow nutritious food and the ability to be a steward and a messenger of the Old Testament, and it feels really good. I mean, I don't get all puffed up with myself because I realize the importance of my insignificance.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it would be unethical for me to discover these things and only use it on only a few people. That would not be fair.
Well, amen.
Yeah, so it's just, let it out there, let people see it, use it, taste it, experience it. And if I'm right, like I said, I'll be telling it about it in 100 years.
Yes, well, we're all going to wait to see that, and I bet a lot of people are going to go try it.
Well, I hope so, because they'll be the people I'll be talking to in 100 years.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing this exciting story. I mean, I feel really good about the fact that you heard it here first.
Well, Melinda, it's a great pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, thank you for being here, and God bless.
God bless you.
Good night.
Good night.
And that's our show for today, Friday, October 19th, 2007. All of us need the truth. Without that, we can't prepare to meet what's coming, survive, and build that better world for our children. The first step on the path to truth is a willingness to hear it, even when that truth brings you pain. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. but when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
About Cinderella, and we tore